are talking about superconductivity, let's just talk about a fluxoid. Which says, let me take a ring of some material, and I'll give it some width. But the wave function we're going to look at has no radial dependence. And of course, if I really gave it a width, there is a radial dependence. And the nice piece of what distinguishes a fluxoid from just a coat hanger, which is also a ring of copper wire, is that there's no dispersion over this system. So we can think of that we have an electron, and the wave function for that electron is spread over the whole ring, and that there's no decoherence, there's no loss mechanism, there's no scattering, okay? And of course, so no scattering, let's just put it that way. And of course, one way of getting no scattering is to have a superconductor. But we don't need a superconductor. All we need is a material that has no scattering. So be in the region of ballistic transport. And at room temperature, if I have copper, the electron can travel about 80 nanometers before it scatters. And it's a length scale that we can actually probe experimentally. If we cool it, or we use other materials, you know, graphene has a much longer free path length. And so we could build devices. And if we have this ring, then we could say that we have some wave function, and of course, the only thing that happens in that wave function is we have some phase relationship around the ring. And of course, the solutions are going to be that, I want to actually say that that's theta, that phi is equal to n theta, right? That the wave function must be continuous and it must be single valued. And of course, rho is the particle density. Now, by itself, this piece isn't so interesting. But, well, let me say one more thing here. We have a particle density, and we can talk about the current of that particle density. And so I can describe the electron current. We'll indicate it by J. So it's just given by the gradient of the wave function. And of course, the charge and the mass of the electron, if it's an electron that we're talking about. Okay. Good. Now the interesting piece comes because we have this hole in the middle. And so we can connect it to a magnetic field. And so then if I have a magnetic field that's threading this, then I need to replace the gradient I need to subtract off the vector potential. And so then, having done that, we can rewrite the current density. Write all this out for you. And yeah, we reduce it to just fitting in our wave function. So now we have our current that depends upon the magnetic field. But for our device, we want the current to be zero. So the current, it's a closed ring, so, and it's in steady state. So the current is zero. And then we have this nice relationship. That we can relate the gradient of the phase to the vector potential of the magnetic field. Now, given this, we can look at the change in phase over the whole ring, okay? And what that will give us is that the phase change over the whole ring is given by this quantity. I'm going to tell you what that is in a second. And of course, the phase change of the ring is quantized. Therefore, the flux over the ring is quantized. And so phi is equal to n h over e. Okay, so now then, we seem good. We say, oh, I can take a current loop, and if the current loop is closed and ballistic, then I'm going to quantize not only the number of phase evolutions that I can have around the ring, so how many times of 2 pi I can go around the ring, but I'm going to quantize the amount of flux that can sit there. And so what's going to happen is you put your ring somewhere and you have some external flux. But then you have some flux that's sitting in your ring. And the flux that's sitting in the ring, of course, is limited to integer multiples of Planck's constant over the charge of the electron. And of course, what makes up that difference is a persistent current that goes through here. And so then you could imagine, you say, okay, I'm going to take this fluxoid and I'm going to change the field over the fluxoid slowly and continuously. And the field outside of the fluxoid, you can do that with. But of course, if you had a device to measure the field inside the fluxoid, you wouldn't see that. Then you would see steps. And imagine that you tune your external field to half of a flux quantum. So half of this value. Well, then your system, the current in the flux in the ring, doesn't know whether it should go half in the positive direction, right, and take you up, or to go half in the negative direction and to take you down. And so if you're biasing the ring so that you're sitting near the half flux quantum, then you have this double well potential where you can say, oh, I should be adding minus a half of a current, or I should be adding plus a half of a current, and either would have the same energy. And so we end up having a double well potential or a qubit. And the qubit is most naturally thought of in terms of the flux state. But of course, it could also be thought of in terms of the currents in the ring. They're all the same. Yeah.
So I don't really understand this, because you said that the current is quantized, right? That's like what.
So the flux is quantized.
But didn't we derive that from the current being?
No, we described it from the current being continuous. Now, I did at one moment make a sleight of hand of saying I'm going to take the current to be zero so I could calculate the flux quantize, flux, right, the quantum of flux. But that's okay, right, because that's just a moment in time. You know, this is always true. Yeah? But we're still going to have this quantized version that we can only fit certain flux quanta into the ring.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's weird. But you know, basically it originates because the wave function has to be continuous around the ring.
Okay, maybe I just don't understand like the step between like current is zero and the phase difference is that, and like flux over the, I don't know.
So take this to be zero, so that we're asking what is the field in the case of zero, okay? And then stick in your wave function, go ahead and calculate the bloody thing, and you'll end up with the same conclusion, okay? And you know, you don't get away with saying, as you change the external field bias, you know, there's no external field bias that can make the wave function not continuous. So for the wave function to be continuous, you have to have these steps. If you want to see, and I did leave out some steps, but they're trivial to go through if you spend a moment. You'll find it in Feynman. There's lots of places you'll find it, but Feynman's always a good place. Now, this piece by itself, we could use as a qubit. But it turns out that in order to use it as a qubit, We don't have an easy way of measuring the flux inside of this ring. And there's no other controls. The only control is what we do with the external field. So what we want to do is use something very similar to this. But one, I'd like to make it bigger than the tens of nanometers we could do with copper. And I'd like to give us a few more control knobs. And so that's what the superconducting circuits aim at doing. They aim at providing a dynamic, which in the end, the quantization is very much like this, but you get some more control knobs. Now, to make it bigger, of course, we go and look at superconductivity, and this is for a conductor, meaning we have electrons. If I have a superconductor, meaning I have Cooper pairs, then we pick up a factor of 2, because a Cooper pair is 2 paired electrons. And probably you know a little bit about superconductivity. Of course, discovered at the turn of last century, around 1908, and which was the first time that we could liquefy helium and pump on it. So the first transition was discovered in mercury, because you can make mercury really clean. You need a clean material for superconductivity. And the transition temperature is just over 4 Kelvin, so below that of liquid helium. But if you pump on liquid helium, then by an evaporative cooling, you can get down to 1 Kelvin. And Kamerlingh's Oenis demonstrated that. The other piece to say, you know, the Cooper pairing, you have this pairing that happens because of phonons. You know, you can think about that you have an electron and it's going to distort the lattice, and so it's going to, you know, electrons repel electrons, but if I have an electron that distorts the lattice, then it's going to pull the positive charges to it and creates an effective attractive potential for another electron. And if you follow through that physics and you allow a condensate of these bosons, then you get superconductivity. But we don't need any properties of superconductivity. We could do the whole thing just in terms of a normal conductor if we had one. But since we don't, then we have to take this. In order to make our fluxoid more interesting, we need to include a transport. So I want to be able to measure the current, or I want to be able to measure a voltage. I want to have a phase that I can control in this system. And so conceptually, what one does, and in terms historically in practice, is to do something called make a weak link, to take some piece and squeeze it. And superconductivity says that I have Cooper pairs that will transport scattering free, provided the critical current, provided the current is below a critical value. And so by squeezing a little spot in a superconducting wire, then we can create a piece which is normal. And so then we introduce a tunnel junction that for the wave function, all of this is superconducting so that there's no potential. And here, there's a potential that the wave function has to tunnel through. Now, the nicer way to do this is to take a metal. So a good metal for superconductivity depends upon this phonon scattering in order to create Cooper pairs. A good conductor is a bad superconductor. And a lousy conductor can be a good superconductor. And aluminum is a nice superconductor. And it makes a wonderful oxide. So we can make a tunnel barrier out of aluminum, aluminum oxide, and aluminum. And you know from your experience with aluminum cans that the oxide of aluminum is hard and it's very thin, right? Your aluminum cans are dull unless you scratch them. They're dull because of this oxide. But if you leave your aluminum can on the shelf for a long time, it doesn't continue to oxidize. It oxidizes for a rate-limiting step, and then it stays there. So it can make a thin junction. And of course, if I draw up some tunneling wave function, then there's a finite probability that we can go through some potential. So here we have some potential that we're going to tunnel through. And the tunneling probability where V naught, of course, is the height of the potential. L is the length of it, E is the energy of your incoming particle, and this quantity alpha looks like that. And of course, it comes in this way because you're interested in where the potential is higher than the energy. And the only point of writing down this probability is to emphasize that these parameters are under your control. So, you know, up till now, if we said, oh, I want to use an NV center as a quantum bit, or I want to use a trapped ion, or I want to use a proton, then you know, nature gives us those Hamiltonians. We can change the Hamiltonian on average over time by doing something to it. But, you know, at the end of the day, we have to start with what nature gives us. Here, we actually have design parameters so that we can say, I want to control the height of that potential, or I want to control that width of the potential. And so it's a little bit of a different world. Okay, so now we have our tunnel junction. And what Brian Josephson did when he was still a graduate student was to ask the question of would a Cooper pair tunnel through a junction? And so he more or less by inspection wrote down two relationships. And it's not that hard to show that they're consistent with the physics. It's a little bit more involved to prove them, but you can prove them based solely on the continuity of quantum mechanics, and Feynman did that at some point. So this phase is now the phase difference across the junction. And immediately, that should open up the idea that we have a design piece here. Because on the fluxoid, then we were forced to have an integer number of an integer of 2 pi phase changes around the ring. Here, we're going to end up with a phase change that depends upon the ratio of the current to the critical current. And so over this junction, we have a continuous variable in terms of this phase that we can dial up by changing the current. But the phase over the rest of the ring, of course, the wave function still needs to be continuous. Yeah, you had a question.
Yeah, and so what is this physical current? And if that is it the same for all superconducting materials or different from others?
So the critical current is a function of the material. And you know, if I have recent materials, YBCO, so-called high-temperature superconductors, the critical currents can be thousands of amps in a conductor. If I have aluminum or niobium or mercury, then it's much, much lower. Yeah. So there's a rich physics associated with that. Now, we're a little bit in trouble here because, okay, we've got these two pieces that Josephson suggested, and we want to use this piece with all the properties that we have with the fluxoid, except we have some control. And there's two pieces that are essential to this. One, that as the Cooper pairs tunnel through the weak link or through the tunnel junction, that they don't break into two electrons. And Brian's faculty advisor said, that what's going to happen is that this tunnel event is an event that each electron sees the potential individually. And so the probability of tunneling is suppressed. It's exponentially squared suppressed. And, blanking on his name. Bardeen said, you'll break the Cooper pairs as they go through the tunnel junction anyways, and so your system will scatter, it'll become resistive, you won't have any quantum effects left. And the nice thing is that if these two equations, if these two relationships hold, then you can prove that both of those arguments are wrong. Okay? So let's have a look. The first thing we'll look at is the so-called DC Josephson effect. So I have a current, and it's going to flow through this tunnel junction, and I'm going to measure a voltage across it. Right, so this is my voltmeter. And I'm going to send a current through here. And so classically, of course, no current flows, right? You have an insulator in line, so classically nothing happens. But according to this nice equation, you have current flows, but no voltage appears. As long as your current is below the critical current, then as you change the current, you'll change the phase difference across. But that phase difference doesn't show up in a voltage. That phase difference would only show up back here if you had a loop and you were measuring a magnetic field. So the first thing that's really counterintuitive is that if you have a tunnel junction, it's still superconducting. Okay? So tunnel junctions remain superconducting. And then you have the AC Josephson effect. That says, put a voltage over your tunnel junction. Okay, so we place a voltage there and we measure the current. Well, from Josephson's second piece, we know that d phi dt is equal to 2e over h bar times a voltage. Therefore, phi is equal to 2. Phi changes linearly in time. So the phase changes linearly in time, right? That's like a frequency where we keep wrapping around. So what about the current? Because we're measuring the current. Well, if the phase is changing, then remember that the current is equal to IC sine of this phase. Therefore, the current oscillates. So I apply a DC current. I put a battery over the junction. And what I find is that the current will oscillate. So you can make an oscillator with just one junction. And still, it's dissipation free. And the frequency of this, that frequency, is equal to 2e over h, which is 4.8 times 10 to the 14 hertz per volt. Now, famously, Josephson still is a graduate student in 1962, went and gave a talk where Bardeen and his advisor Papard were both talking. And so Bardeen gets up and says, Josephson's wrong. that tunneling will break Cooper pairs. Pippard gets up and says, oh, he's right. Except the effect is 10 to the power 20 smaller than he thinks. And fortunately, the experiment was done at IBM very shortly after and shown that he was correct. And therefore, there was absolutely no reason for him to share the Nobel Prize with all these people that were telling him he was wrong. So it worked out well for him. Okay. So now then, this is the physics. Yeah.
So in summary, having a junction there does not stop it from being superconducting.
That's right. So you know, Brian sort of gets there by saying, oh, this is what makes sense. It has to be this way. It was proven after the fact by Feynman that, yes, you know, this is consistent with our understanding of nature, and the continuity of the wave function already demands that this should be the way it works. But it isn't a surprising effect, right? You go from saying that that we have a junction which is going to lead to a tunneling current, okay, but that the phase over that junction is a well-defined quantity. This, in fact, the only thing you need is to say, you know, right? Because if it's scattering free, then there must be a phase, because now it's just a potential. All right? And if you limit yourself to that, then it doesn't matter that you're talking about superconductors or you're talking about normal conductors. It's just that superconductors, because we can control the scattering length much better, we can make bigger devices out of. Good. Now, this piece, you know, at this point, really one could stop and just say, ah, what's the potential of this? Draw, go ahead and allow yourself to measure a voltage across this so that you had a degree of freedom. Give yourself some way of injecting a current, and you would be done. But it's useful to take a moment and convert to electrical engineering thought and think about, okay, let's now actually take these ideas and build something out of it. Now, if we're an electrical engineer, of course, we need a symbol for everything. And so this is the symbol for a Josephson junction, always described as a JJ. Sounds friendly. And if I have this junction that it has two conductors with an oxide in between, then as we think about that, we want to include all of the electrical engineering that can happen. And so we say, well, okay, this piece looks like a JJ. But there's also two pieces of metal that are smacked together with an insulator between those. And so that looks like a capacitor. So in parallel with this, there's a capacitance. And it's an insulator So it's never going to be perfect. So there's always going to be some other conduction paths. And it turns out to be a big issue of make your device well, that there'll be some stray thing that we don't want in there, and it allows a little bit of current to flow. And so there'll be a resistor. So this is described, of course, by the critical current. And here we have a capacitance. And at this point, you might say, well, we're going to be dead. We'll never be able to make a quantum device out of this, because we've put a resistor in. And you know that if we want a quantum device, we don't want any noise, right? So you say, well, what are you doing putting lossy elements in my beautiful quantum computer? Which is what we're doing right there. And what saves us is we'll be able to operate in a regime where this piece has no voltage across it. Right? We're saved right here by the DC Josephson effect that says there's no voltage across it. So that resistor and the capacitor are there. We need them. But they don't show up in the dynamics of the circuit because there can't be a loss in this resistance, in this resistor, unless there's a voltage across that resistor. Yeah? There can't be any current through the capacitor unless I have a voltage change across that piece. Okay? So, this becomes our circuit element. And then what I'm going to do, I'm going to take this circuit element, and I'm going to put it into that ring. And then I'm going to show you that we get a nice potential out of that. And what it's going to depend upon, once I have this ring with, so that's a shorthand for a Josephson junction, with this Josephson junction, is again, we're going to end up saying that I have some external field. Let's keep it. And I have some internal field. And I'm going to bias this internal field so we're at that half point. And then if I look at the potential, pretend it's at zero, versus, you can think about this as flux, or you could think about it as a phase, or you could think about it as particles. We'll end up having both a cosine dependence because of that oscillating term, and we'll end up with this parabolic dependence because we've got these pieces. And we'll organize that there's exactly two bound states in that double well potential. And we'll use these two bound states as our computational basis. And I could think about this as current flowing left and current flowing right. And that's the same picture that we had when we said we're going to bias at this half phi naught point, where the current doesn't know whether it should flow left or right. So we'll have an equal superposition. And of course, the other picks up a phase. And this piece happens where phi internal, did I call it qubit? Is that? Let's call it bias, so I don't get too messed up later. And if I take that bias. To be finite or multiple poles of finite, then we'll end up in the single well potential. And here we'll have our two wave functions, our two eigenstates sitting in there. And so we can move between these two for control, or we can directly excite over these. Okay?
Wait, what do you mean by the second picture? Why is there a single well?
There's a single well because you've got this parabolic and cosine potential. And as you're changing the bias, what you're essentially doing is shifting over the cosine potential. And so it depends upon how that shows up locally.
So the wave functions
locally
should look different, though, in the single well, right? Like, they should be, like, degenerate.
No. These are the eigenstates of that well.
But they should not be the same character as, like, the well above, right?
So the eigenstates, I give you any well, and the first two eigenstates look like that, right? Every time I go up in energy, I need to add a node.
Right. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so
I see, but these aren't.
So you can't say that I keep, you know, these are just a basis for that potential, which is not the same thing as saying that this one goes into that or this one goes into that,
so the
right?
The two in the above go into the one in the bottom, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but I mean, here, it's a little bit nicer that you crank up Mathematica and calculate, because it depends upon the shape. Mm-hmm. And of course, it isn't really parabolic for the rest of it, right? Because the cosine potential continues. We just treat it this way so that we have a nice, easy picture to get our hands around. Okay, now, so next class we'll go over the electrical engineering of going from here to here. The other piece that's worth thinking about. So when, back in late last century, people thought about making such devices, then they treated the qubit as though it was going to the qubit with a weak link, as though it was going to be a qubit, it was going to be the control element, it was going to be the way we coupled, because of course the flux from one qubit can affect the next if you put them next to each other, and that you would have lots of little bobbins so that you could control the magnetic field for each of these little devices. And then it was found that, and what you would do is you make a slightly more complicated device that is tunable. So I won't show you that, but I can put in another couple of junctions. And I can give myself a phase difference so that I can change the depth of that well. Then it was determined that those things weren't very coherent or not very controllable. And so we went as a community to saying, oh, let's make one device which is really clean. And for quite a period of time, looked at making better and better and better single qubits. And then the question was, well, how do you control them? I mean, for a single qubit, you can control it by applying microwave fields between this energy separation, which turns out to be a convenient 3 to 7 gigahertz. Then it was seen that, we could introduce in the same process, a superconducting resonator. And now this was a nice piece because I could use the resonator via what we talked about last class to control these. And so the resonator became the control element of the superconducting qubit. Then resonators got so good, and although the qubit lifetime is still long, it's nowhere near as long as our ability to keep a photon in the resonator, that we're moving towards saying, oh, I can use these devices to control the state of the qubit, right? These now give us the gates. And the qubit, well, it's going to float around the system, but it's mostly going to live in the resonator, where we're going to be able to exclude noise sources from interacting with it. And so it's a very fluid field, which is sort of nice, right? That the way components are used as we learn more and more about what they're good for changes over this time. And so it eventually becomes, I think, that these circuits are going to be effectively what we control the qubit with, but the qubit will be some photon that's floating through our system. Okay, so we'll see a little bit of that next class. Questions?
I have one.
Yeah.
Do you have the control to shut off tunneling in the Josephson junction, like between left and right currents?
You know, that's a great. It's a great idea. And if we're making magnetic devices, we can do that. So we can take a magnetic device, and because I can have two magnetic domains and I can change their relative orientation, then I can change that potential. And of course, since tunneling is an exponentially sensitive piece, you can make a huge change. The trick is that Cooper pairs don't like magnetism. And so now the question is, can you have a magnetic tunnel junction that works with Cooper pairs? And the recent results look very promising. So it's something which is duck soup to do with electrons. But it's just an emerging field with Cooper pairs. And maybe there's some other parameter other than magnetism. It's, well, let me give you an example. You've seen that, maybe you haven't seen. We can start to make use of phonons as a coherent quantum system. And so another way of doing this is to say, oh, let me take a material that's a piezoelectric and put it in here and try to introduce a control element over that. And there's been a little bit of work there that might someday give us a control element that doesn't require magnetism. But the field of using coherent phonons is really a very recent development. Other questions? Okay, thanks.